something Me'inyan HaDiyoma, something I plan on discussing for a while, but through the lens of a Rambam, based on the Mishnah in Masechta Megillah, followed by Gemara and Daf Kaf Ches, where the Mishnah talks about Vashimosias Mikdashechem Afal Pi Shehem Shomamin Bikdushasen Hin Omdin, that Bate Knesios and Bate Midrashos as well, places where the Shechina is felt, the Mishnah says Bikdushasen Hin Omdin. And the only difference between the way that we treat them when they're fully standing and when they've been destroyed are two areas of halacha, of kibud and rivut, which is sweeping it out and putting down some water to keep the dust away. And then the Gemara comments something very interesting, is that, you know, in their destruction, it's likely that grass or weeds will grow. Yalu bahem asavim, and the Gemara says that you should be tolesh the asavim. Don't feed them to an animal or anything like that, but just to leave them, as the Gemara says, mipnei agmas nefesh. So people should be distressed to see a destroyed shul. So the Rambam in Perek Yud Aleph of Hilchos Tefila Halacha Yud Aleph Paskins bate knesios bate midrasho shecharvu biktushasen hein omdo shenemar vashimosius mikdashechem avu bishen shomim in biktushasen hein omdin ukeshem shenogin bahen kavod biyishuvan, just as one has to honor a place of shechina, frankly not just honor but mikdash yitirao, sense of yira, lo min hamikdash atayarei elo mishat tziva Al Morao, a place of Shechina is entitled to demanding of Kavod and Yira. Kach Noagin Bohen Bichur Banan. So that never leaves. Kedusha Shechina is never Betela. We know that in terms of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, we paskin Kedusha Rishona, Kitchela Shaita, Vilo Kitchela Sidlavo, except for Kedusha Yerushalayim. Because that was Kedusha Sashchina. Kedusha Sashchina, the Rambam tells us, is Eina Betele Leolam. So this seems to be the same idea, that just as Kedusha Yerushalayim is not subject to nullification because it's Kedusha Sashchina, the Kedusha of Beis Knesset and Beis Medrash, which is also Kedusha Sashchina, is also not subject to being batel. It's reminiscent of the Gemara, frankly, in the first parak of Masechta Brachos, and Daf Ches, where Rabbi Yochanan is Tamua. How is it possible that people have Arichos Yamim in Bavel? After all, Pasuk says, Laman, Yirbu Yimeichem, Yimevinechem, Al Hadama, Asher Nishba Hashem Avoseichem, Laseis Lachem. Bavel is not part of Eretz Yisrael. And Ika Sabe B'Bavel was a source of Tamia, of astonishment, for Rabbi Yochanan. Who remembers the answer in the Gemara? Yehuda?
I'm sure
I don't
remember.
Eitan?
Eitan? Does the Gemara say that
Arichos Yamim
is not just on this world, but it's on the next?
Not in this context. Gemara Kedushin says that. But based on our analysis, what would you say? Shimi? Well, the... Again, based on the analysis that the Kedusha Shechina is manifest, David.
Really, that's maybe the Kedusha of Israel is from the Torah and what goes on there. So if they carry that to a foreign country, that Shechina must there as well.
So, Mashkimim Umarivin, Ubate Knesios, Ubate Midrashos. The Gemara says that they are in embassies and consulates, so to speak. It's almost sovereign territory of Eretz Yisrael in the sense that it's the same makom hashchina, because it's not as if they're spending their time in municipal halls and other places, but because the community in Bavel oriented themselves around the mikdash ma'at, so they too were privy to the shchina in that way, and for that reason they were subject to the same bracha of l'man yirba yimeichem v'nechem al ha'adama. Anyway, that's the part of the Rambam here, which is just derived straight from the Mishnah and the Gemara. However, the Rambam, you know, Kedarko is Mechadesh, a very important principle. Again, according to the Gemara, the reason that you're Tolesh the Asavim, the weeds and grass that grow, and you just throw them down, you know, on the ground in the Beis HaKnesses or the Beis HaMedrash, is Agmas Nefesh, that people should be distressed to see a Makom Shechina, which is Charev. Listen carefully to the words of the Rambam, and somebody tell me how the Rambam departed or built off of the Gemara in a very profound way. Alu Bahen Asavin, Tolshin Osan, Umanichin Osan Bimikalman, fair enough. Kedesha Yiru Osan Ha'am, Vita'ur Rucham, Viyivnum. Kedesha Yiru Osan Ha'am, Visa'ur Rucham, Viyivnum. Shimmy, what's the Rambam saying? Precise. Agmas Nefesh is not intrinsically valuable, but we're not looking to distress ourselves, despair ourselves for no reason. The Rambam says means that the people should see it and have a sense of an impetus and a motivation that it's intolerable that a Makom Shechina should be left in a state of churban. V'ta'or rucham v'yivnum. This is, I think, the Rambam l'shitaso in terms of his approach in Tanios in general. You know, the Rambam says we mark certain days that have been calamitous days historically for the Jewish people. This is Rambam Hilchos Tanios Parkei Halacha Aleph and continues on. So the Rambam says in that case that the point is not simply to remember terrible things that happened and to be distressed, but the Rambam says the whole point is kidei la'orer halavavos, the same language really here of ta'or rucham, but la'orer halavavos liftoach darchei atshuva, that we should introspect and be able to, as much as in our control, reverse the calamitous effects, whether it's Tisha B'Av or the events in the Taniyos surrounding Tisha B'Av, the Mishiva Asar B'Tamuz and Asar B'Teves and Som Gedalia. For the Rambam, that's the whole point. It's not, you know, Taniyos just for the sake of, you know, afflicting oneself, but in a sense of driving one forward and the impetus to rebuild. So it's really through that lens that I wanted to discuss Kristallnacht with you. This is, of course, the 80th anniversary to the day of Kristallnacht, night, overnight. How many of you are from German extraction? Okay. I could guess based on your last names. So I want to first go through some of the history, much of which is known to you, and to give you two or three things to think about. Obviously, the reason that I frame this in terms of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, is that 1,400 places of Kedusha were destroyed across Germany and Austria. Austria because it had already been subject to the Anschluss by November of 1938. 1,400 shuls. Think about how our community, what took place in Pittsburgh, one shul, imagine 1,400 shuls. 1,400 places of Shechina destroyed. 7,500 Jewish-owned businesses ransacked, destroyed. That's why it was Kristallnacht. Kristall, of course, in German is glass. You literally walk the streets across any German city the next morning to see that, you know, how many just storefronts were destroyed. But more important than any of those statistics, you know, it was thought for a long time that 91 people died in the pogrom of Kristallnacht. But truth is, there's really much more than that. 30,000 Jews disappeared overnight, were sent to Dachau, Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen. Many of them were never seen again. So the death toll from Kristallnacht can really never be known. Significantly in excess of 91. And so, of course, today we remember Kristallnacht both in terms of places of Shechina that were destroyed, but also in two very other important respects, which is why it's critical for you, young as you are, to internalize these messages. Number one, Kristallnacht took place during a time when Germany was still very well covered by foreign correspondents, unlike events subsequent to that. Kristallnacht was on the front page of the New York Times. You can go to the archives and look. Kristallnacht was reported by the BBC and by all of the major news outlets of the day. And it shocked even many, and according to some historians, most Germans. There had never been anything like it. Even with the passage of the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, this level of violence and vandalism had been unprecedented. And the relative silence of the world gave the German people a sense, I would say the German government more precisely, that it was possible to do certain things, more or less get away with it. Did the United States break off diplomatic relations with Nazi Germany over Kristallnacht? No. Yeah, they recalled the ambassador. It's not a minor diplomatic step, but it's not breaking off relations either. Did the United States at that point say, we're going to open up our doors to refugees from Germany? Absolutely not. To our shame and discredit. In fact, the British at that point decided to take in 10,000 Jewish children, one of whom was my wife's grandmother. My children are alive because of that. The Kinder transport. The United States reacted, or more precisely, did not react in that fashion. The quota laws of the first half of the 1920s were left in place. And even though 115,000 German Jews fled the country in the immediate aftermath of Kristallnacht, many of them had no place to go. Some of them, of course, ended up in Cuba, in South America, escaping through Belgium, various other places. But the relative silence of the world is something that we absolutely have to remember in the wake of Kristallnacht. The Nazis themselves, and this has been documented by historians, both Goering and Goebbels felt that it was the first step in the final solution. Of course, the final solution would not be determined until December 1940, January 1941 in Wannsee, but they felt that this was the first critical step along the way. In fact, Goering, commenting in his avarice and insatiable, greed. You know, what a shame it was that they destroyed and looted so much property, instead of simply just expropriating it. And as everybody knows, who was responsible, of course, to pay for the damages of Kristallnacht? The German Jewish community was fined 1 billion Reichsmarks, or in today's U.S. dollars, approximately $5.5 billion. And Goering said better to have killed, all the Jews and taken their property than to have, ransacked so much property, which is in fact precisely what they would do from that point on. It was a critical testing ground for the final solution, and the world, by and large, and I have to single out the British government, they didn't say we're going to take in all German Jewish refugees, which of course would have been much better, but the 10,000 is significant, and it's personally significant for me. Personalize it in one further way. My wife's grandmother, Betty Wolkenfeld, later on Betty Hauser, had an ear infection during early November 1938 and needed to see a doctor. But with the danger of going out to the street, where Jews basically went into hiding, she was unable to see a doctor. The infection grew worse and worse, and she lost a significant amount of her hearing for the rest of her life in the ear that had been infected. Just small things that'll never be measured in the 7,500 stores, in the 1,400 synagogues, and the 30,000 people who were taken to concentration camps, the 91 who died overnight. This impacted people in ways that you would never read about in a history book. Can I make one other point, which is of great relevance today. Actually, 2 points. German law enforcement will have two individuals who are going to give first-hand testimonials. In my shul tomorrow, we have two Kristallnacht survivors. A German law enforcement received a direct order, and I include the fire departments in this as well, not to intervene in the destruction of Jewish property. Ken Hartak, who is from Hamburg, told me this, he'll speak about it in our shul tomorrow, that as he was walking that day, he saw his family shul on fire. And you ask yourselves to imagine for just a moment how you would feel if you saw your shul literally burning. So he ran to go find the fire department, and he realized he didn't have to go so far. And the entire fire department had lined up across the street, all the fire trucks, a major German city. Hamburg is a very large German city, okay? And had lined up across from the main synagogue in town, his shul. And he runs over to one of the firefighters and says, "Save the shul." And he says, "We're not here for the shul. We're here to make sure that the surrounding buildings don't burn down." So contrast that with what we saw almost 2 weeks ago today, 2 weeks ago tomorrow, in Pittsburgh, where, thank God, law enforcement and emergency response services risked their own lives for the German, for the Jewish community of the United States. Thank God we're living under very different circumstances. We all have to have hakaras hatov to law enforcement, to emergency response services here in the United States of America. But I want to conclude with a very important point about hatredism and racism. Who remembers what the pretext, that's the only term for it, that was used by the Nazis for launching Kristallnacht? What was the pretext? Judah?
That some Jew who was in France had killed a German.
Right, so Herschel Greenspan, not far from your age, about 17 years old, who had been in Poland, heard that his family was summarily deported. When the Germans just kicked them out of their home with nothing, shirts on their backs. And he was incensed. And he took action. He went to Paris. He killed basically a mid-level German bureaucrat in Paris who, ironically, history revealed, had been under investigation by the Gestapo at that time for not being sufficiently anti-Jewish. He's a German civil servant, basically. A man by the name of Ernst von Roth. And the propaganda was, so you see, you know, Herschel Greenspan's Jewish. So one person from the group committed this act. That means that the whole group, you know, has these characteristics. And this is perhaps the oldest and most common canard perpetrated by racists, bigots, anti-Semites across the world. You can point at any group, say, oh, there are people from El Salvador and MS-13. What does that mean then, if you're a racist? All Hispanic, Spanish-speaking people are, you know, dangerous. You can find Muslims that committed acts of terrorism. And what does that mean if you're a racist? Every Muslim's a terrorist. If you're Arab, you can find Arabs. Right? Jews commit acts of violence. Jews are violent. They're dangerous. Gays, any group that you want, you can always take an isolated example. Take a few individuals and then perpetrate the hateful, vicious lie that everybody in that group is exactly that way. Serves your agenda, serves your purposes. And collectively define people along those lines. And that's precisely, it's not like we have to guess about this, that's precisely what the National Socialists did, using, again, the murder of Ernst von Roth, which took place in a certain context. I'm not saying it was a wise thing for young Mr. Greenspan to have done. Obviously, it was calamitous in retrospect. And again, with Ernst von Roth had absolutely nothing to do with you know, his family's deportation. But be that as it may, a pretext that was used to launch the worst pogrom to that point in Germany. And so you all need to be trained to identify this kind of a tactic. And to be able to see through this kind of a facile, incendiary logic, if you can call it that, that is still used to this very day when people wish to defame or fearmonger, spread hatred about particular groups. Take isolated examples and project them as the norm for that group. You know, school shootings. It's a plague in this country. The first major school shooting took place in Columbine, in Colorado. Now, one of the two individuals who committed that terrible massacre was Jewish. And thank God, nobody was around at the time to say, oh, you see, the Jews, see what they do, they shoot up a school. They're a danger to society, they have to be rooted out. Could have happened. Thank God it didn't happen in this country. But don't think for a second that it can't happen in this country. Because if you would have asked a German in 1931, is it possible that 7 years from now, Kristallnacht will take place? Nobody but nobody would have said, yeah, that seems likely. That seems like a distinct possibility. My grandfather, Zichron Levracha, the Holocaust survivor, would always say, civilization is but a thin veneer. Everything looks normal on the surface, but beneath the surface, the forces of hatred and bigotry, anti-Semitism, as the oldest form, can be unleashed in very dramatic ways. Okay? And so one of the critical lessons of Kristallnacht, of the Greenspan von Rath story, is that people with an agenda, with hatred, are always looking for specific examples to utilize and justify the hatred that they feel. And there are always going to be aggrieved people in any society. People who are angry for whatever reason, economic displacement, cultural displacement, who are always looking and ripe to be brought onto this bandwagon. Again, National Socialism in Germany in 1923 was a joke, and a bad joke. Not 10 years later, Hitler would become the Chancellor of Germany. And not 10 years after that, death factories would be operating 24/7 in Auschwitz and Treblinka and Chelmno and Sobibor. In the blink of an eye, from a historical perspective. And so Kristallnacht is a very significant day with eternal lessons for all of us. Of course, from a halachic point of view, Vashimosius Mikdashechem Afal Pishem Shomimin Bikdushasan Hinomdin. And as the Rambam taught us, Kidesha Ta'or Rucham Vyivnum, that in the wake of a Kristallnacht and all the destruction that followed, our sense of rebuilding Klal Yisrael has to be that much greater. And make no mistake about it, you may think of the events of 80 years ago as somewhat distant. In a second. But history will look at our generation, just like if you were thinking about somebody who lived in the second century. Okay? You would say, oh, they lived 100 years after Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Your lives will be perceived from the perspective of Jewish history as having taken place in the shadow of those events. And when you learn Torah, when you become active and God willing leaders in the Jewish community, you're responding to that in the way the Rambam taught us to, not just Agmas Nefesh for the sake of Agmas Nefesh, but Kedei Sheta'ar Rucham V'Yivnum, to rebuild. Rebuild Jewish life, Torah, Batei Knesses, Batei Medrash, with everything that goes on there. Mekomos Hashchina. And that's at one level. And the second level, again, is to appreciate from a historical and geopolitical point of view how dangerous silence is. Well, the Americans were waiting to see what happened. We recall the ambassador. We're not going to break off diplomatic relations. And then it was just too late to do anything about it, as Jews could no longer safely emigrate. The British, again, who responded sooner, can't say it was enough, but it was something. I'm grateful my children are alive for it. They understood the situation. So when you see something happen, you have to react, whether or not these people are from our group, right? It's easy for the Americans to say it's not our problem, Jews aren't our problem, right? Our historical experience of suffering, according to the Torah, and this is more repeated more often than any other message in the Torah, is Ki Gerim Hayisem Eretz Mitzrayim. It's supposed to make us more sensitive to the suffering of others. Number two, and number three, is understanding the tactics of hatred, racism, and bigotry. And the tactic, the most basic tactic, is find an isolated example and turn that into the norm. A defining, inalienable characteristic of a group. So you see, somebody who speaks Spanish did this crime. What does that mean? They are dangerous. You see, a gay person did this crime, they have to be rooted out. A black person did this crime, a Jew did this crime, a Muslim did this crime, they are dangerous. These are the tactics of hatred and bigotry. They were utilized against our people. They have been utilized against many other groups of people. There were a couple comments. Itai?